This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are with Dennis Hayes. We are in Oberlin, Ohio, in the Lewis Center for Environmental Studies, which is one of those stories, I think, of one guy had this great idea and then worked it out. Now, it took a lifetime to do it, but he also drew on the resources of 2,000 years. He drew on the resources of a community. He drew on the youth that surrounds him. I'm talking about David Orr. Mm-hmm. And he's got you here, and he's got lots of people here to celebrate a building, which is not an end. It really is, in the classic sense, a commencement address. Mm-hmm. It is a beginning. Isn't that part of why this is exciting, that some guy up in Northeast Ohio and some guy coming out of college, hadn't quite finished as I remember. I guess you did finish before you went off and worked with Gaylord Nelson. And again, Gaylord Nelson, some guy.
There are women who've done things here too, Paula.
Well, some of us graduated. That was an accomplishment.
Rachel Carson.
Persons, yeah, absolutely. Persons who have done things. Thank you for making me more politically correct. That sense of "and do something" rather than just despairing seems to me to be essential to all of us.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that seems to happen is that people have a child or two. And as soon as you have a child, then suddenly you realize this isn't just your fight and it's not just a casual thing. You want your kid to have a world to grow up in.
Is it really that serious? Because I think a lot of folks say, okay, Dennis, you've made a lifetime and a living being an alarmist. Okay, it is. I wish you could see this face.
No, again, it's been these self-undoing. I'm not saying that in youthful enthusiasm I would want to have every utterance of mine subjected to peer review by the National Academy of Sciences. Sure, I've made some mistakes as well. But by and large, they've mostly been mistakes of understatement rather than overstatement. And I think that that's largely true for the environmental movement. In fact, it's a source of some despair at times that so routinely we have underestimated the size of the risk, but nevertheless managed to stir up enough public sentiment to ward it off. The real question, and I don't mean to keep beating the same drum, but the real question is whether that sort of technique, which has been very effective at issues that are local, statewide, regional, and national, can be applied in an international framework on an issue where, you know, if America stopped producing CO2 next year, just shut it down, 75% of global warming would continue. And at the rate that other parts of the world are growing in their use, that ratio would be even more. We've got to get everybody jumping at the same time. And that's what the movement has been less effective at figuring out how to do. It's one of the reasons, frankly, for Earth Day. We took Earth Day International in 1990, and by 2000, we were in 181 countries. It's a remarkably effective recruiting device to bring people into a concern for environmental values and a commitment to environmental action. And it's an effort to start addressing these global issues.
Paula mentioned the image of Earth seen from space and what that did when you were first starting Earth Day. Images help, and I think it might help. And radio is not necessarily an easy medium, but assuming you could achieve what you want to achieve, if you could get the policies in place, if you could get people thinking and doing the things that people need to think and do, what would a world look like in 2015? How would my life be different? How would the world I inhabit be different? How would what I do be different? How would the expectations for children, my children, be different?
You know, one of the strange things is that we never anticipate the way that changes will come. Most everybody who's thought carefully about those issues has thought of them in a framework that tries to leave our current lifestyles largely unaltered. And in fact, you can do all of that in a way that leaves our lifestyles largely unaltered. We turn to a series of renewable energy resources for our energy. We begin to dramatically increase the amount of stuff that's recycled, which in the best of the cities is now up over 50%, but it becomes nationally in the 90-95% realm. You find people living in houses and buildings like the one that we're talking in right now that seem like regular buildings and they're very comfortable but use dramatically less energy. And that's the way that people do the calculations that talk about how much you invest here and there in order to drive yourself to a different point in some projection of future resource consumption. In fact, though, it's entirely likely that dramatic changes that we can't even imagine will take place. At the time that the three of us all were graduating from college, the concept that I would have spent this morning answering 85 emails, linking up on a really slow, I should say, telephone line in a hotel. What in the world is email, and how's that transferring? Well, email turns out to be how you organize 181 countries affordably around the world, because it's essentially free, fast, instantaneous communication. And the kinds of changes that we've seen in area after area lead me to believe that certainly life in 2015, but let's even go out to 2050, would be very recognizable today. But the economy is likely to be dominated by a series of devices that nobody has even thought of yet.
Well, a very near-term example of that is the internet itself. In addition to email, one's ability to access stunning amounts of information that may or not be true.
And stunning amounts of misinformation.
Indeed. But I mean, that is real easy for most people to remember. We were talking with Latvi Zada not long ago, who was the father of fuzzy logic, who says the world isn't Aristotelian. It's not black and white. The world itself has all kinds of gray. We all know that. And helped us to think about, well, remember life before faxes? And email and the internet and answering machines. Well, not before answering machines. Life didn't exist before answering machines. But this nature of change as being dramatic, I guess Per Bach would say, that it comes cataclysmically. Whether even good change, that things change dramatically. Is that good news or bad news? Or is it just news?
It's just the way stuff is. I mean, including evolution, which we now understand as punctuated equilibrium as opposed to the slow curves that the early Darwinians thought that it followed. Stuff tends to come in ways that are completely unexpected. And some of it's going to be bad stuff. I found Bill Joy's piece in Wired about the threat that comes from human devices that can self-replicate, whether they are computer viruses, bioengineered viruses, the fruits of nanotechnology, some of the small robots that suddenly are able to make identical robots of themselves, which admittedly at an incredibly simple level now, but in the longer term hold threats of basically, in some sense, ultimately replacing carbon-based life forms with dominant silicon or gallium arsenide-based life forms. Nobody would ever make that decision consciously. No company would ever make the decision consciously to make something that held that kind of a threat. And yet in a competitive environment with multiple things happening in 220 countries around the world and hundreds of different enterprises there, a little something here that gets a competitive edge, a little something there that gets a competitive edge, and suddenly, in this case, bad news rather than good news, you are in a terrifying new environment where there's a bug out there that the world has never developed defense mechanisms against and that has all of the characteristics that are needed to take out humanity.
Personal.
Yeah. And that's plausible. I mean, I was talking to a very, because this was sort of a privileged private conversation, I won't go into who, but I had a detailed conversation with the guy who is of a quality in this realm that he's a prospective Nobel candidate. Built a couple of companies, has some substantial assets, made some brilliant insights, and basically said, if you were setting out, if you suddenly went crazy and you decided that the greatest threat to the world was humankind and you wanted to take out humankind, could you do it? And he thought about it. You know, spent a few minutes, and he said, you know, I'm not sure. If you look at the great influenza epidemics and the other things that have taken out so much, there's enough complexity that we don't understand still in the genome that it's likely that almost anything you'd come up with, there would still be resistant strains of humans that would overcome it. And then you'd know. It says, I'm reasonably confident that I myself without government subsidies or criminal gangs or anything, just with I myself, with my laboratory and the money that I have in the bank, could take out 90% of mankind. That's a genie that's now out of the bottle. So are you saying
the stakes are high here, Dennis? Is that what I'm supposed to take from this story?
Well, it's in some sense what I'm saying is the most elementary CP Snow kind of observation, which is that we have proven to be enormously clever little primates, and we have not yet got enough wisdom accumulated to make me confident that we're going to be using that cleverness in ways that are entirely beneficial.
Our guest is Dennis Hayes. He is chairman and CEO of Earth Day, which he helped found in 1970 and continues in his good work. He is with Bill Russell and me in Oberlin, Ohio. The three of us will be back in just a moment. Please join us when we return.